So last time we were talking about the mind, the fact that the body and the mind have distinct continuities because they have different natures. One's atomic in nature and one is formless and clear and aware in nature. So they have different continuities. Now within this thing that we call mind, there's various types of mind. Okay, so I kind of outlined it last time when we were talking about the five aggregates, saying that one of the aggregates form is the body, and then four of the aggregates apply to the mind. So you have feeling and discrimination, and then this fourth aggregate is kind of a grab bag of all sorts of other mental factors. And then the fifth called conditioned factors or conditioning factors. And then the fifth one is consciousness, and that's referring to the six primary consciousnesses. Yeah, so that we can see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and, you know, mental consciousness, which thinks, and the mental consciousness in some conditions can also have direct perception. In other words, to know an object without a thought. So the primary consciousnesses know the general aspect of the object. So a visual consciousness sees colors and shapes. It doesn't hear sounds. Okay, your auditory consciousness doesn't smell smells, it hears sounds. Okay, so each of these consciousnesses has its own distinct kind of object. But it's not just the primary consciousness alone that cognizes the object. Each primary consciousness has a retinue of different mental factors that have different functions to help you cognize a certain object. Okay? So in any perception that you have, there's going to be a mental factor of feeling. And here feeling doesn't mean emotion, it means feeling as in pleasure, pain, or neutral. Okay? Every cognition's going to have a mental factor of contact, because that is what connects the object to the consciousness via the sense organ being like your eye, ear, those things. Okay, you have attention, so that's a mental factor that is going to direct your attention to a particular object. You have intention, okay, that's one of the critical ones, which, you know, has an intention towards an object. And then you have discrimination. So, you know, the mental factor that's going to know certain, be able to identify certain qualities of an object. So those five, according to a sangha, accompany all the different cognitions. A sangha is one of the great Indian sages from the 3rd century. Vasubandhu has a different way of formulating everything. Vasubandhu is his half-brother. he's also a great sage. So within the feeling and discrimination are both mental factors themselves, but they're set aside as distinct aggregates because they play such importance any time we're cognizing something. Because whenever we have a sensory experience, a mental experience, we're feeling pleasure, pain, or neutral. Okay? And that's going on all day. Yeah? Now, feeling pleasure, pain, or neutral is no big deal. But what happens after that is we react to the feelings of pleasure, pain, and neutral. And that's where we start having all sorts of emotions coming in, and then those emotions prompting different behaviors and so on. Okay? So you walk in the kitchen, there's a pleasant smell. Fine. Pleasant, you know, smell. No, not smell doesn't go here. Smell goes here. Okay? And then there's a feeling of pleasantness that accompanies that cognition of the smell. No problem, nothing negative. That's just what's happening. Then the mind says, ooh, pleasure. Ooh, what's that smell of? Ooh, must be chocolate chip cookies. I remember last time I ate chocolate chip cookies. It was good. They make me feel good. I want some. Okay, so attachment arises. Then how am I going to get some? Okay, they were cooked for the whole abbey. So I can't just kind of go in there and take one myself without everybody else getting one. Unless I think of some good way to do that. What could be my way of getting a chocolate chip cookie? Okay, so then it's going into covetousness, which was one of the ten non-virtues. Okay, then, I think I'll distract the cook. Anyway, cook's kind of distracted anyway. I'll just play on that. Achala, come here. Will you do something? Distract the cook? Yeah. Achala readily, cooperates. So the cook gets distracted following Achala. And we just stroll in and, I think I'll take a cookie. Can't have just one cookie. Could have two cookies. Oh, can't have two because now they aren't in even rows. So I better take three that might even the rows out. Okay, and on, okay? So you get the idea? So it started with just the contact, of the smell of the cookies, which, that is as it is. But then the pleasant feeling is where we got hooked, okay? Because our uncontrolled mind, in other words, the mind that is not careful about what's going on, the mind that isn't mindful, then as soon as we experience pleasure, that mind generates attachment and clinging and craving. Okay? As soon as we experience displeasure, there's the voice of somebody saying, clean the toilet. Your chocolate chip cookies are in there. The remainder of your chocolate chip cookies are in there. Go clean the toilet. So there's that sound that hits the ear. That sound isn't the problem. And, it may have a harsh tone or whatever to it. That's not the problem. But actually what happens after that is the mental consciousness says, somebody's telling me what to do. Yeah. Now who are they to tell me what to do? Just because the remnants of my chocolate chip cookies are in that toilet, so is the remnants of everybody else's chocolate chip cookies in that. Why should I clean this toilet? Yeah. So there's a feeling from the side of the, you hear, so the sound may have a pleasant or unpleasant sound, but it's the mind that gives meaning to the sound, Because from the side of the person, there's no, they're telling me what to do. They're telling me what to do is our interpretation of the event. So that's happening with the mental consciousness that's thinking about all of this. Okay? So as soon as we interpret the event in that way, as they're telling me what to do, as soon as we interpret it that way, then we are, our mind, we've pre-programmed our own mind to, I don't like when people tell me what to do. And then that leads to, I'm going to fight back. And then that leads to saying certain things, doing certain things, whatever. Okay? So there's a number of steps in here. And that last part is all happening within the mental consciousness. It's not your ear that's thinking that. Okay? So, the pleasant or unpleasant that you hear with your auditory consciousness is just about the quality of the sound. But then it's the mind that is putting that sound together and giving it a meaning. And then our habitual mind that says, I don't like being told what to do. Okay, now that's coming from us. Yeah, there's no rule in the universe that says we have to dislike being told what to do. There's no rule in the universe that says every time somebody asks us to do something that they're telling us what to do. Okay? So in other words, we are imputing meaning onto this statement when the person says, please clean the toilet. Okay? We are imputing they're telling me what to do. And we're also imputing no one can tell me what to do. That's not permissible in my world. Okay? And then, okay, so do you see how that stuff is coming from our own mind, our own patterns, our own ways of interpreting? And then another pattern is, okay, what do we do if somebody tells us what to do? Well, some people have more of a pattern in just kind of crumbling and, yeah, okay, I'll do it because otherwise they'll criticize me, but being unhappy and resentful. Other people have the habit of, well, I'm going to go tell them to do it, you know. Other people have the habit of, well, I think I'll go ask them if somebody else can do it, you know. So we all have our own habits of how we deal with situations that we describe to ourselves in certain ways. But you see, all of that is coming not from outside, it's coming from in here, isn't it? All coming from in here. The only thing that came from outside is the sound of the words. Pretty amazing, isn't it? Because we get into such super reaction over this. You know, you told me what to do. You're always telling me what to do. You're so bossy, you know. And then we think we know everything about the other person and we start judging them and, you know, the whole nine yards. All of that is coming from our confused mind. But because we're ignorant, we don't realize that it's coming from our own confused mind, and instead we think it's coming from the side of the other person. Okay? And because we think all of that's coming from their side, then, you know, our self-centered thought feels very threatened, and we have to react to protect our sense of self. But we never stop to question of, how is somebody asking me to clean the toilet threatening my sense of self? You know? Stop for a moment and think about that. You know, somebody asked me to clean the toilet. Is that threatening who I am? Is that going to be a big, you know, something? Yeah? It's not very significant, is it? Yeah. And somebody has to clean the toilet. It might as well be me, because what they said is true. The remnants of my chocolate chip cookies were in there. So, why shouldn't I clean the toilet? You know? Because we also have all this stuff about what does cleaning the toilet mean? I mean, actually, if you look at what is cleaning the toilet, you take a brush, and you take some water, and you take some cleanser, and you go, and you flush it. It takes about 45 seconds, 1 minute at longest, okay? It doesn't take very long to clean a toilet. You know, that's if you're really professional. Some people who dawdle, it takes them a while. But it really doesn't take long. But it's very interesting how we have all these associations of what clean the toilet means. Yeah. Clean the toilet means I am low on the scale of what's important. It means I am meaningless. It means other people are better than me. It means I'm not effective in the world. It means, you know, I can be degraded. And so all of a sudden being asked to clean the toilet becomes a whole attack on our self-esteem. Yeah? Somebody's threatening my self-esteem. Do we ever stop to ask, are they threatening my self-esteem? And why is asking me to clean the toilet a threat to my self-esteem? And why do I think cleaning the toilet is something demeaning? Yeah. Who's supposed to clean the toilet if I don't? Well, my maid. Who's my maid? All of the other sentient beings. Yeah. Okay, so it's very interesting to just stop and ask ourselves some questions here. You know, why do I interpret things in all these different ways and give them so many meanings? And then why do I react in the ways I do to all the meanings that I project on this stuff? Okay? So if we start watching how our mind works, and we begin to stop it at different places, you know, that's how we learn to understand ourselves and to manage our own mind. The same thing with the example of the chocolate chip cookies, you know. We have a pleasant smell. Yeah. From the pleasant smell, we could go, I offer that to the Buddhas. Yeah. We could go, may everybody who's incarcerated have the pleasant smell of chocolate chip cookies and be able to eat chocolate chip cookies. They, all the people who are political prisoners or, you know, whatever kind of prison, may they have this beautiful smell and a beautiful taste. And may I offer this to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as well. From having the pleasant smell, you know, from the olfactory consciousness, we could easily go there. Why is it that we go to, you know, oh, chocolate chip cookie smell. Then our mind says, that smell belongs to that cookie. That cookie I've had before will make me happy. I want happiness at any expense. Therefore, I will, you know, hatch my plan on how to have a chocolate distract the cook. You getting what I'm saying? Okay, so all this whole proliferation is coming from our own mind. It's not coming from outside. There's just a smell there, that's all. Okay? So this is where we slow down and we begin to watch how the mind works. You know, being able to identify, when do I feel pleasure? And then watch what happens as soon as I feel pleasure. Where does my mind go with that pleasure? Okay? Or when I feel something, have an unpleasant sensation. Can I just stay with the unpleasant sensation? Or does my mind make a story about it? Yeah. Oh, I stepped on something when I was out in the woods. Okay? So, oh, there's an unpleasant feeling in my foot. Okay, that's all. Unpleasant feeling in the foot. Yeah? Now there's a million places you can go from that unpleasant feeling in the foot, can't you? Your mind can, you know, because that's just your tactile consciousness feeling that sensation of, you know, what unpleasant feeling because you stepped on, I don't know, a branch or a thorn or something. Okay? So that's there. But then your mind can go in so many different directions. It can go in, may I take on the suffering of all beings who have unpleasant feelings in their foot? Yeah, you can do the taking and giving meditation. You feel pain, then immediately you take on this, imagine taking on the suffering of all beings who are experiencing pain. That's one way to go from that. Yeah, that's your mental consciousness, but that's one way to react to the unpleasant feeling in the foot. Okay, somebody else may have unpleasant feeling in the foot. Then it goes to the mental consciousness. Who put that thorn there anyway? You know, don't these people know that when they do such and such, they should make sure to get rid of all the thorns? You know, these people are so stupid, they don't get rid of the thorn, on and on and on, and getting furious. Okay, that's another place somebody could go. And do you see how that whole reaction is just thoughts in that person's mind? Completely thoughts in that person's mind. Did anybody deliberately put the thorn there, wanting them to step on it? No. Did anybody deliberately say, I think I'm going to be unconscientious and scatter thorns around so that people will step on them? No. You know, but our mind makes up some big story and then gets really upset. Okay? Somebody else, their mind, same unpleasant physical feeling, you know, tactile feeling. And then they'll go, oh my God, I stepped on a thorn. I'm sure I'm going to get tetanus and diphtheria and typhoid. And I don't even know how you catch typhoid, but I'll probably get it this way anyway. And, you know, that's not how you get typhoid. But anyway, and then I'm sure, you know, there must be a cancer virus in the thorn, and now I'm going to get cancer in my foot. And, oh my God, my foot is killing me. Rush me to the hospital, you know. And then we make a big production. Okay, you know, and go the route of poor me, and I'm injured, and you know, my foot's going to be amputated, or I'm going to get cancer, or you know, the world's ending. Okay, where's that coming from? The mind, isn't it? Yeah. Completely, that person writing their own script, describing this, the meaning of the situation to themselves in a certain way. Does that meaning exist in the external situation? No. All there was an unpleasant feeling in the foot. Basta, finito. Okay? So it's very interesting to start to watch and see how our mind works and where things go. And, yeah? And this is a very, very good way to save ourselves from a lot of misery. Especially to watch how immediately on, whenever we have a sensory from the five senses, a feeling of pleasure, how our mind immediately goes to attachment and craving. When we have an uncomfortable feeling, how our mind immediately goes to aversion. How when we go to aversion, some people go the explode route, some people go the self-pity route, some people go a whole bunch of other routes. Okay? But just to watch how when we are not mindful, we just work on habit. And particularly a habitual way that our mind interprets things and describes things to ourselves. Yeah? And so much of what we describe to ourselves does not exist outside. Yeah? And our ignorance is we think it does. We think it's coming from the external situation. The whole description is coming from inside of our own mind. Okay? When we see this, then we begin to see that if we want to be happy, we have to find ways to work with our minds. And, you know, and we also realize that the more we're able to work with our own minds, the happier the people around us are going to be, because then we're not going to be projecting so much false stuff onto them. Yeah, because we project lots of false stuff onto other people, and then that causes a lot of conflict and unhappiness, doesn't it? Okay.
Mm-hmm. With the five omnipresent mental factors, mm-hmm. two of them are two of the five aggregates.
Mm-hmm.
The other three, do they mm-hmm. fall into conditioning phenomena?
Yeah. So of the five omnipresent mental factors, feeling and discrimination are two of the aggregates. They're, and the other three are part of the fourth aggregate of conditioned phenomena. The reason that feeling and discrimination are separated out as their own aggregates is because they play such an important role in how we relate to the world. Because we can see just by the feeling, you know, how feeling really is such a big thing and how reactive we are to feeling. And then discrimination is what identifies one thing as this or that, or, you know, identifies different objects or characteristics of objects. So those two qualities make a real big difference on how we relate to things. And so that's why they're separated out from the other mental factors and listed as their own aggregates.
So when we discard the aggregates and take on a new set of aggregates, obviously I guess that implies that different people having new set of aggregates, different sets of aggregates, find different things to be pleasurable and different things to be painful. With the compositional factors, do those, I mean, like, I don't know, do they change like that also? Do they kind of get replaced by different?
Yeah. When somebody dies and is reborn, all the aggregates of one life cease, but the aggregates of the new life come into existence. Okay, now there's a connection between the, at least in term, and the mental aggregates, there's a connection between the mental aggregates of one life and the mental aggregates of the next, because there's the factor of habit, having done something, and also there's the factor, done something repeatedly, and there's also the factor of karmic, you know, karmic seeds being there. So that, for example, you know, our kitty may be angry, and when he dies, if he's born as a human being, may have a tendency towards anger. Yeah, but hopefully we've been curing him of that over the years. Okay, so there can be, you know, tendencies like that that are passed from one life to the next. It doesn't mean that those tendencies are cast in concrete, that just because you come in with a lot of habit about anger, that means this life you're doomed to be very angry and there's nothing you can do about it. You know, because habit, you know, habit is not a solid thing. Habit is just the fact of doing something repeatedly. So as soon as we start setting up another habit, you know, because we're full of different habits and sometimes very contradictory habits, aren't we? So you set up a new habit and you start going down another road, and then, you know, that tendency changes.
How do you distinguish between habit and karma?
Habit is what we impute on actions that are similar. I have a habit to eat breakfast. Why do I have a habit to eat breakfast? Because every morning there's the action of eating breakfast. So because most mornings, sometimes you skip breakfast, because most mornings there's an action of eating breakfast, we say I have a habit of doing it. The habit has no other existence aside from being a convenient term that covers all those similar events.
And the tendency to do them again in the future.
Yeah. You know, the because you're familiar with something, then it's easy to do it in the future. Yeah, we can see that in our regular life, isn't it? You know, if you do something often, it's easy to do it in the future. Karma is the the disintegratedness of the action. I don't want to get into a lot of philosophy with this, but it's the having ceaseness of the action that we did, and that having ceaseness has a certain potential to produce different results. Okay, so the karma can produce four different kind of results. The ripening results, which is the realm we're born into, the kind of aggregates we take. The result that corresponds to the cause in terms of our experience, so that we experience things similar to what other people, what we've made other people experience. The result that is similar in terms of the action, in other words, here's the tendency to do the action again. And then fourth is the environment that we're born into. So a karmic seed, you know, or a disintegratedness can lead to those four results. It's a little bit different than a habit. Okay?
One more question. With the description, Asana's description of the five aggregates, where does the clear knowing fit in that? Is it part
okay.
of that?
Okay, so when we talk about the definition of mind being clear and knowing, how does that relate to the five aggregates? Well, clear and knowing is the definition of mind in general. When we subdivide mind, then one way of subdividing it is into primary minds and mental factors. Okay? So all of those have a nature of clear and knowing. Okay?
So I agree, like, when you go in to say the conditioning factors and pull out anger, that anger has a clear knowing.
Yeah. Yeah. But that anger does not exist by itself without any other mental factors being present, because you have to have the primary consciousness, in this case a mental consciousness, with which it is affiliated, and then other mental factors are also associated with that mental consciousness. Okay. What's interesting about many of the afflictions, such as ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, jealousy, and so forth, is these things are all considered conceptual consciousnesses. They're considered thought consciousnesses. Now, in American language, we think of emotions and we think of thoughts as being different, don't we? You know, we think of thought as you're thinking about something, and emotions like anger or something like that, well, that's just feeling. But remember here, we're using feeling to mean pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. We're not using it to feel to mean emotions. But Buddhism doesn't divide things up that way. It says rather that the various emotions are also thoughts. Yeah, they are conceptual consciousnesses. So then, what's the difference between a conceptual consciousness and a non-conceptual consciousness? Okay, so a non-conceptual consciousness is a direct cognizer. In other words, it knows the object without any mental image or any what we call a meaning generality. A meaning generality is like the general meaning of the object appearing to the mind. So a direct cognizer sees things directly like that. Like if I look at green, there's just green appearing to the visual consciousness directly, okay? That's very different than if I start to think about green, okay? So the first moment there might be green appearing to my visual consciousness. Then I can be still looking at the green, or I could even shut my eyes, but then my mind starts saying, oh, I like that color green. It's a really pretty green. Venerable Tsimkhe did a very good job picking out this color green, you know, and on, you know, this is the same color green that, you know, in the door curtains in Gotami House, you know. And then we go on, oh, and Jessica and Daniela offered the door curtains. How kind of us. They're from Mexico and they do this thing for us. Oh, I really like going to Mexico. Those people are nice and the weather is much warmer. But the government's kind of a mess. Well, so is our American government. And, you know, they're shipping arms from Texas into Mexico. And do you see how distractions work in your meditation? Okay. Starts out with seeing green, and then the conceptual mind takes over. Okay? So what, you know, on many of these things, if you're just aware of what your direct perception is, then you can stop all this conceptual elaboration that is distraction. It doesn't mean that you're trying to get rid of all concepts and thoughts altogether, but you're definitely trying to get rid of the ones that are distracting, that are taking you away. Okay? So, the consciousnesses that have direct perceptions, that's the, you know, visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, and tactile, those consciousnesses only have non-conceptual cognitions. Okay? Those consciousnesses don't think. You don't have a mental image of those things. You don't have those consciousnesses, don't ruminate about them. The sixth consciousness, the mental consciousness, is the most important one for us, because in some cases it can have direct experience, but a lot of times in our current experience, our mental consciousness is conceptual, and we're thinking all sorts of thoughts, interpreting different things. So we interpret things in different ways. Then different emotions arise. Those emotions are also conceptual consciousnesses. Okay. So there's a lot of concept going on, and if you watch your emotions very carefully, yeah, you can see how the mind is creating so much stuff. Because you can sit here in perfect meditation position, you know, you're not seeing anything, it's pretty quiet, you're not hearing anything, you're not smelling, you're not tasting, you know, you're not paying attention to tactile situations. But your mind can create a whole drama, can't it? You know, in living technicolor, complete with, you know, incredible emotional impact. Okay, that's all conceptual consciousness that's happening in the mental consciousness. Okay, that person you're thinking about, that you find desirable or undesirable, you're not perceiving them through your senses at that time. They may not even be in the room. Okay, you're having a general image of them, a meaning generality appearing to your mind. Yeah, and then you confuse that appearance with the actual person, and then the mind starts proliferating. So these kinds of conceptual consciousnesses are a big disturbance in our daily life and a big disturbance in our meditation practice. So those are the ones that we're trying to work on. There are other conceptual consciousnesses that are very good. So for example, right now, you know, during a teaching situation, we're using language, we're using concept, aren't we? You know, you're hearing words, you're imputing meanings to those words, you're putting the meanings together and getting further meanings, you're thinking about those meanings in terms of your life. So all of that is conceptual consciousness, but that's a very good use of your conceptual consciousness because it's going to help your wisdom grow. Okay. Now, of course, eventually when we get to high stages in meditation of realizing emptiness, we want to go beyond concept. But even just to realize emptiness, we have to start with conceptual minds because we need to hear teachings on emptiness. We need to think about those teachings. We need to discuss them. All of that involves concept. Okay? So there we're using concept and, you know, the mental conceptual consciousness in a useful way that will lead us eventually to go beyond concept to mental direct perceivers, okay? And so these mental direct perceivers, they can know emptiness directly, okay? Or if you develop samadhi, then you can know other objects directly through your mental consciousness.
Yeah? A two-step question. So you said it, or more like, you know, it's just one question. So you say you have, if emotions are conceptual, that is a two-step. The first part is, do Buddhas actually have, when you attain Buddhahood, are you pretty much no more concepts and therefore no more emotions? And is bliss something else then, for example, or what?
Okay.
What's going on there?
So, do Buddhas have concept? No. Okay. Do Buddhas have emotions? Yes. Not all emotions are conceptual. Okay. So, for example, if you're feeling love or compassion or joy or equanimity, those are emotions. According to our Western meaning of emotions, the Buddha certainly experiences those. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but those are not conceptual consciousnesses for a Buddha.
Is that direct perception?
Yeah, for a Buddha. Buddha only has direct perception. Okay.
I thought that wasn't sure because of the emotion part.
Yeah.
So, is it that just a... I mean, didn't you just say that emotions are conceptual consciousness?
I should have been more specific. Disturbing emotions are conceptual consciousnesses. Yeah, so, yeah. Please excuse me. Disturbing emotions are conceptual consciousnesses.
Okay. All virtuous emotions are...
All virtuous emotions, some of them could probably be conceptual, yeah.
But they could also be...
non-conceptual, yeah.
I guess when you have fabricated bodhicitta, for example, that would be conceptual.
Right.
So you get to actual bodhicitta.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
So any feeling of love, for example, that we now have is not conceptual? Is that what you're saying? Or are we saying that if I have a feeling of love now, it is always conceptual and therefore it's not?
I'm not saying anything about our present feeling of love, whether it's always this or always that. Attachment is always conceptual.
Mm-hmm.
In the mind of a Buddha, the virtuous emotions are always non-conceptual. In us ordinary beings, they could probably be a little bit of both.
Okay.
But see, this is why when we do the meditation on love, why we think about things in order to get a correct understanding of what love is.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a silly question, but this is kind of coming back to feeling,
mm-hmm.
and the good, neutral, and bad aspect of it. And just if a person walks into a situation and they have an experience, oh, this is very pleasant smelling. And similarly, another person walks into a situation and says, oh, this is very bad smelling. Isn't it the case that they're automatically going to be? Isn't the very basis the fact that they're having feeling? Doesn't that? I mean, there's no way to not have the follow-up, or is it? Because if you identify it as good,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, torture or dentistry or you know, sadomasochism or whatever. You know,
yeah.
I don't know, but in that way, I mean, a lot of it seems like it's just this, you know, you force them to that.
Okay, so you're asking about going from feeling to either attachment or animosity or apathy as a reaction, or resentment or arrogance or anything else. Okay, when we are not mindful, we just operate on automatic, and that's what happens. But and that's what leads to karma, and that's what leads to rebirth. One of the places where we can cut this whole thing is that place of between feeling and what happens after feeling. Okay? Because if you have a feeling and you just stay there with the pleasant or the unpleasant, and you just feel it without letting your mind start conceptualizing about it, wanting more, wanting it to go away, resenting it, feeling arrogant about it, this, that, and the other thing, but you just feel that, then the feeling itself is transient, it's impermanent. You just have the feeling, and after you have the feeling, it's over. And there's no story, okay? And there's no disturbing emotions getting all shaken up about the whole thing, okay? So that's actually one of the weak points in the whole chain. But when we aren't mindful, as soon as there's pleasure, boing, we go into attachment, like push button. Yeah, isn't it? Yeah? Or as soon as there's displeasure, boom, we go into, you know, anger. Without, you know, without even a split second in between. Seems like, doesn't it? And it's so quick in ignorant beings, this reaction, that we almost think that the pleasant feeling is the attachment,
yeah.
And the unpleasant feeling is the anger. So that person is making me happy, that person is making me angry. But they aren't. Okay? There's a pleasant sensation, there's an unpleasant sensation, but the anger, the attachment, is coming from within us. They're not making us feel that way.
So when we do some forms of like meditation where we're watching, is that where we're trying to get our foot in?
Yeah, that's one of the places, yeah, where we definitely want to be aware.
Sorry, could you explain?
Yeah. Okay. When you're doing, let's say, a mindfulness meditation, yeah? So one way is mindfulness of the feelings where you're watching these pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. Okay? Or even if you're doing the breathing meditation and something else comes in as a distraction, then you divert your attention to just feel, you know, feeling pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and then come back to the breath. Okay?
So you're saying we react present, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral to even our own thoughts?
Oh, yeah. 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 If you, I mean, some of your thoughts, you react with their pleasant thoughts. Yeah, when you're thinking about peanut butter mixed with M&Ms. Yeah, okay. You know, then that's a pleasant thought when you're thinking. Yeah.
So you can see why we get confused about the feeling being... The aversion, but we actually create a feeling just from our thoughts. Mm-hmm. So we've got
Well, there's a feeling coming from the sense sensation. But then once we start thinking about it, the thought itself has a feeling component. Okay? So when you're looking at the M&Ms mixed with the peanut butter, when he's looking at them, not when I'm looking at them, but when he's looking at them, you know, there's a visual consciousness of that. Okay? So it might appear beautiful. Then his mind goes from the visual consciousness to a mental consciousness that is remembering the taste of previous peanut butter mixed with M&Ms. Or if he's never had that combination before, imagining what it's going to be. And that meaning generality in the mind of what it's going to taste like, even though he's never had it before, that mental cognition has the feeling of pleasure with it too. Okay? Meanwhile, he hasn't tasted anything.
But what I'm thinking about is that sometimes I sit here in meditation and I create these scenarios that have absolutely no sense basis at all.
Yeah.
And I go into the pleasant or unpleasant.
Unpleasant route, completely, completely. Yeah, it's your thoughts. And there's a feeling component to the thought as well. Because remember, thought is feeling is one of the omnipresent mental factors.
Into Tantra in terms of the perception of feeling, forgive me, I was just going from the gut here. I'm sorry, I've been thinking about things before. Just insofar as that we manifest the pure will, we manifest things that we feel great bliss towards, but is there until you've recognized certain levels of reality. Mm-hmm. You can't really do that, or can you? I mean, is it just kind of make believe? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. I'm getting what you're saying. So you're saying, how does Tantra handle feeling?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and then also, or how do you apply that? It seems like a fairly high level of skillful means
to be able
to do that.
Right.
And even broach the topic of Tantra without mm-hmm. having accomplished that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why the realization of emptiness is so important in Tantra, because you have the feeling, and instead of seeing it as truly existent, you try and see it as dependent arising. Okay, and you see it as dependent arising and empty, and then your mind doesn't go to attachment from there. Okay, so it can still be a pleasant feeling, and you can use that pleasantness, you know, to keep your attention on something. But you're not seeing it as inherently existent, so you're not going into attachment, grasping, and craving with it. Okay, Kevin?
I want to go back to what Leiter first said, talking about feeling. He used the words good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
And in my sense of the way I've heard that presented, that for me at least, pleasant and unpleasant is really different than good and bad. And that
yes.
when I use good and bad, I've already put my mental mm-hmm. attachment or aversion to it, as opposed to the saying pleasant or unpleasant, because
yeah.
then I can separate that. When I say good and bad, I've already made a judgment of some
yeah.
kind of
mm-hmm.
what I perceive.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's very good. You know, with feeling, if we label it good or bad, then we're already into attachment and aversion. Pleasant and unpleasant, there's a little bit of space there to not go into attachment and aversion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's interesting, you can see in the thought training teachings, is when you have an unpleasant situation or an unpleasant feeling, you train yourself to say, oh, that's the result of my negative karma. How good this is happening. Or if you can't stop it with just the feeling of the sense perception feeling, if your mind is starting to go, oh, I don't like this feeling, and it's starting to react with aversion, then you say, again, you know, oh, actually, I don't need to feel aversion. It's very good that I'm having this feeling, because I should rejoice at this feeling, because it's the, you know, it's the fructifying, it's the ripening of my negative karma, so I'm very happy about it. Okay? So you don't, instead of making up the story of, you know, I'm going to die tomorrow because of it, you change the story into something that's more realistic. Okay? And by the fact of you're applying your wisdom to change that story, that's what makes it purification. Okay? Because you're generating wisdom in response to the situation. Because that came up the other day when somebody was talking about, you know, if you're born in the hell realms, aren't you purifying the negative karma? You're not. You're just experiencing the result of the negative karma. But it's when you generate a virtuous mind in response to that feeling that that's what's going to make it purification. Okay. Let's sit quietly now. Think about it. We'll dedicate and then you'll have a break, and then you'll be able to really explore this in your meditation. Hmm? I just remember the major points right now. Let's dedicate. Due to this matter, many sinned. Attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious body, mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.